Do public schools stifle creativity and real learning, or are they the necessary fabric for a diverse society? Is homeschooling a viable alternative to public schools? And if you consider yourself a progressive and want your educational choices to help not just your own family, but society as a whole, how does homeschooling figure into the equation? These are some of the questions we'll talk about. I'm Steve Paulson, and my two guests are Astra Taylor, an independent filmmaker who's just written a provocative article in the literary magazine N+1 titled Unschooling, and Dana Goldstein, an education journalist who wrote a critique of Astra's article in Slate, arguing that homeschooling is never truly a progressive option. Since then, the two have gone back and forth with follow-up responses, and today we're going to delve into even deeper questions about education and learning and schools and all of that. Astra, let me start with you. To put this in context, I think we need to talk about your own experience of unschooling, which is a much more radical version of homeschooling. First of all, can you explain the philosophy behind unschooling?
Yeah, well, and most people have an idea of what homeschooling is. It's having school at home. Unschooling is sort of the radical cousin to that. And the idea essentially is that we are learning animals. That's a phrase from John Holt, who actually coined the term unschooling. Children, what they do is learn. You don't need to teach a baby how to speak. You speak to it, and then, you know, it masters the art of speaking. And so the idea is that you tap into a child's intrinsic desire to learn by sort of setting them free to explore. It's a very romantic view of human nature, of education and pedagogy. And so when I think back to my childhood, I often envision it as a kind of nutrient-rich broth that my siblings and I were sort of allowed to absorb and move in. You know, there were no tests. There was no class time. Our parents were not our teachers. It was this very informal, child-centered experience. And we are not alone. This is a tradition that goes back decades, but again, really got started with John Holt in the 70s.
And so what did you do? If you didn't have regular class instructions, this was not just sort of taking the curriculum that a lot of homeschoolers use and doing it at home. You had no set structure for a typical day?
No, there's no curriculum, no tests. You know, we would wake up in the morning and, well, what did we feel like doing that day? Maybe we felt like drawing or reading or playing or, roaming around in the woods behind the house. You know, my parents had this sort of boundless faith that we were interesting people and we would find something interesting to do. And that, you know, my mother would say, when you're bored, you're boring. And so the idea was, you know, you should care about the world. You should care about learning. And you, the children, should pursue it. I shouldn't have to be sitting here with carrots and sticks driving you.
Did you get bored?
Boredom was something that, you know, would happen intermittently, and then you'd kind of have to pass through it and say, well, what do I want to do? What do I want to think about? What do I want to make? So it was a different kind of boredom than you experience when you're waiting for an appointment or something like that, or when you're being lectured at by somebody you don't want to listen to. You know, sometimes boredom is that slow, hard period before you're really engaged creatively or intellectually with something. You know, it's not necessarily something to flee from.
Mm-hmm. Now, you say that during all your years of unschooling, you were never tested or graded or told to memorize dates and facts and figures. Did you learn the stuff that students are supposed to learn in school? Math, biology, U.S. history, foreign language, all that kind of stuff?
Yeah. I mean, one thing that you have to keep in mind is the fact that our whole society is absolutely permeated by schooling. So it's yeah, I don't know. You'd have to live under a rock to not have an idea of what school is and what school kids are doing and, you know, sort of where your peers are. That's just something that you absorb by living in this culture. And so, you know, unschooling, I actually think, is a misnomer because it sets it up as something antagonistic or as though you could actually, you know, totally disconnect yourself from schooling. So no, we kind of knew where our peers were at. And there was a sense that we should probably keep pace with them, that would be a good and safe thing to do. And my siblings and I kind of did that on our own. But yeah, as far as math and science, you know, in a way, those are easier subjects to teach yourself because there are sort of absolute right answers. So when you're teaching yourself math and you're reading a book and you're learning to do it, you can sort of check yourself and your method and say, oh, okay, I got that right. You know, I know what I'm doing. People often think those are the more difficult topics, more difficult subjects to teach yourself. But in fact, sometimes, you know, it's the interpretive things, the open-ended questions that are actually more challenging when you really dig into them. I will admit, though, that our foreign language skills were less than ideal. But I would say most Americans share that problem with us. That was something that, none of us took up on our own, and I wouldn't say that we have a talent for it.
Mm-hmm. Now, in your essay in N+1, you go on to say unschooling worked for your family. I mean, you're all mm-hmm. literate. You know enough math to be able to balance a checkbook. You have all pursued various creative projects, you and your siblings, and you, of course, are a filmmaker. It all sounds pretty good. So, Dana, let me bring you into this conversation. Why did Astra's essay get under your skin?
I was sort of troubled by the notion of unschooling and homeschooling as well as a model or something we should look to in terms of how to think about improving public schools. And the reason why is because so few parents have the privilege, have the option of implementing this sort of education for their children. So we know that a third of all kids and half of poor children are being raised by a single parent. And it's just very rare for a single parent to have the option to have the massive outlay of labor that it takes to educate one's child at home. And then the other point that I brought up in my Slate article that I think is really important is that in our society, the social institutions, the public institutions that have the most buy-in are the ones that tend to attract political support and improve over time. So, for example, when you think about Medicare, it's very protected politically because almost all senior citizens do use it. And with public schools, we need to be broadly improving public schools. And there's a growing body of research on peer effects. And basically, the best way to summarize that is to say that children learn more when they're in a classroom with children who have invested parents in their education. So, for example, a poor child learns more when they're in a classroom that is not just 100% made up of poor children, but also has middle-class kids in it. While the middle-class child, their test scores, there's not a lot of evidence that their learning is impeded by the presence of less privileged kids. So I'm sort of making this argument in the Slate piece that we should really think twice about pulling children out of the public system, that if we want to invest in our public schools, if we want to improve them over time, there's a big argument to be made that everyone has a better outcome when more people invest and participate in public schools.
So it sounds like you're not really questioning whether homeschooling is as good as it's cracked up to be. Your focus is on the larger social good, whether homeschooling undermines support for the public schools. And you're saying that we need to do everything in our power to make public schools better.
Yeah, there's two ways I'd respond to that. First, it's clear that for individuals like Astra and her siblings, there can be many positive outcomes of homeschooling. And I've certainly met people who've been homeschooled, have had wonderful experiences, and are wonderful, well-rounded, socially adept adults. I'm not making the argument that some critics of homeschooling make that it's bad for the child. I think for many children, it could be a very positive experience. I'm sort of asking parents who might be considering homeschooling and who do care, who do want to improve public schools, to think twice, because I think that having those sorts of parents and families participating in and invested in the public school system really does broadly improve public schools. And I think there's a lot of interesting research showing that students who attend public schools, who attend socioeconomically and racially diverse public schools, do carry a certain set of values with them into adulthood that are very positive. Now, I think it's clear from the debate that Astra and I have been having over the past couple of weeks that she and I share those values. So certainly you can bring those values into adulthood as someone who's been unschooled or someone who's been homeschooled.
And the point that you just made, that you and Astra actually agree on certain principles, I mean, this is yes. important to make, because neither of you, as far as I can tell, is religious. And we know that a lot of families who homeschool do it for religious reasons. They often do. Christian families don't think that the public schools support their values, so they don't want to expose their kids to the public school environment. That is not what you're talking about. This is really a debate about what's the best kind of education for people with, I suppose you could say, liberal secular values.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I'll just make the point that there's somewhere between 1 million and 2 million homeschoolers or unschoolers in the United States. We're not exactly sure how many there are because it's not a very well-regulated sector, so there's not a lot of data about it. But we know that more than half of those people are Christian conservatives, people who could broadly be described as doing this for religious reasons. However, the number of people who are secular and doing it is growing. It's very hard to say exactly what segment of these 2 million children are secular.
Okay, Astra, let me bring you back into the conversation here. Is homeschooling undermining support for public schools?
I don't think it is. One thing I said in my reply to Dana was that the number of radical unschoolers or even secular homeschoolers pales in comparison to the number of parents who use the public school system but do everything in their power to move to the best school districts and get their kids to the best schools. And that's extremely common, and that's a way of contributing to the socioeconomic and racial segregation of our public school system. And so if you want to impact public education, you know, those are families that we really need to focus on, because they are actually exacerbating the divisions within the system. You know, just the other day, the mother in Connecticut who put her child into a better school using, I think, a family member's address, was just charged with stealing education. She's being asked to pay $15,000 for stealing education, and she's going to jail for it. You know, that's someone who tried to move her kid into a better school district, and that's the punishment. So,
isn't it true that virtually every family, if they have any choice at all, is going to try to construct the best educational environment for their kids? I mean, whether it's out of school or in school, and if it's in school, aren't they going to try to do whatever they can to help their kids get ahead, their own kids?
Yeah, I think that they will. And I think Dana and I agree that what we need to do is think beyond the family and what's good for the individual family. And so, you know, the point of my unschooling piece actually was not just to praise, you know, staying home all day and doing whatever you want. In fact, the entire essay, and it's a long essay, is grappling with my ambivalence towards the implications of this tradition that I was raised in. It's a tradition that I love and feel has so much to offer in terms of its philosophy of learning and trust in children. But, you know, is it scalable? Is the world I want to live in one in which everybody stays home and is educated by their parents? You know, the answer is no. So, you know, what I wrestle with is what are the broader social implications? And I end up visiting this alternative free school in Albany that actually caters to inner city kids who have not been able to flourish in the public school system, or kind of, it's a last resort for them to go to this democratic school.
So this is Albany, New York.
Albany Free School. And so these are issues I'm grappling with. So, you know, I think that actually all parents, whether they want to educate their kids at home or they use the school system, need to think about the larger social good. And so what I think unschooling does, what the thought experiment of unschooling is not, what if everybody stayed home all day? That's not it. The thought experiment of unschooling is, what if we let go of the testing, the fostering of a sort of competitive ethos that focuses on grades, on being at the top of the class? What if we totally abandoned all of these aspects of instruction that we're so attached to, that we think we kind of need to coerce children into learning?
Okay.
You know? That's the thought experiment of unschooling. It's not the home part.
Dana, let me turn to you about that thought experiment. Do you basically agree with what Astra is saying?
I agree with Astra that I'd like to see public schools be more intellectually engaging and less obsessed with test scores and more student-driven and progressive in their pedagogical techniques. Where I disagree is that you need to look at a private school like the Albany Free School, or you need to look at a really radical social experiment like homeschooling or unschooling to find examples of that. I think in our political debate about education, public schools are often just painted as totally failing institutions. And as an education reporter who's been covering this sector for 6 years, I can say undoubtedly that there are just so many wonderful progressive public schools that embrace these same values that Astra's talking about. If you look at the Community Roots School in Brooklyn, New York, which is near to where I live, if you look at the Urban Assembly schools here in New York City, those are schools that are working within the confines of the public system, and they're embracing so many of these progressive curricular and pedagogical values. And so I'm very invested in the idea that when we think about how to improve public schools, we look at successful public schools. Because in our education reform debate, too often we say only charter schools, only strict discipline, no excuses charter schools, those are the only ones that are successful. Or the only way that we can successfully, you know, improve education is to totally get rid of all mandates about what students do and what students learn, which is just that's not realistic in our political debate. We're in an environment in which standards and accountability are driving the education reform conversation. But I think what's hopeful is that there are public schools that are existing within that climate and embracing progressive values. And those are the schools that I look at in a lot of my reporting.
Okay, well, let me ask a more basic question here. Why are public schools so important to society?
I think they're incredibly crucial to society. wow, that's such a great question and not one I often get to answer. But I think they're a place where students of all races, ideally where students of all races and classes and political persuasions and religions meet and get to know one another and share ideas. Realistically, in the real world, that is not often what happens in public schools. In fact, you know, since the 80s, we've seen a resegregation of our public schools. They are more segregated by race and class than they were previously because of conservative judges who have reversed integration orders because of increasing residential segregation. There are so many reasons why. But I think what's hopeful is that we know how to fix the problem. There are many school districts, there are many regions of the country that have actively tried to integrate schools, and those schools are places I think where we should look.
Okay.
I mean, I agree that public schools are a cornerstone of a good society. I absolutely believe that. And I think that you have to, you know, acknowledge the fact that for some kids, it's the only place that they're going to be introduced to. They're going to be given a book, or for some kids, it's the only place they're going to be fed. I mean, public schools are essential. And in the end of my essay, I quote, you know, I go back through time and quote William Godwin, the philosopher, and Mary Wollstonecraft, who most of us know as the mother of Mary Shelley. William Godwin would have had this idea, abolish the schools, don't let the state control education. You know, that will suppress the individual. He had this very individualist attitude. Mary Wollstonecraft's idea as one of the first feminists was, no, we need public schools and we need girls and boys to go there together because the truth should be common to all. And I quote the two of them at the end, and I say, you know, I'm kind of in Mary's camp there. But I think there's a bigger philosophical question. When we say fix the problem of public schools, we kind of have this loose idea of what a beautiful public school would look like with these progressive values and really committed and great teachers. And that's all nice, and that would be lovely. But I think unschooling, if you follow it all the way down, it does ask more radical, fundamental questions. What is a successful school supposed to do in this society? It challenges the idea of the meritocracy, of sort of climbing this educational hierarchy, and it challenges our idea of like what academic excellence is. So, for example, let me ground this in the story that I tell in the essay, which is that I eventually transition out of unschooling because there are no other options and go to public high school.
And this was your choice. I mean, your parents weren't pushing you to high school. You wanted to do this.
I wanted to do it because I felt like, you know, my world was shrinking. You know, I wanted to meet people. I wanted to learn. I wanted to be able to, you know, be an adult with a career. And I was worried that I would be forever sort of branded an unschooler and locked out of adult life. What happened, though, is that for the first time in my life, I'm getting graded and I'm getting, you know, oh, I could get into gifted instead of advanced or this and that. And I start to really see myself reflected in these marks. I start learning for that reward instead of for its own sake. And so, you know, the number of books that I read absolutely just dwindled. You know, I was this voracious reader when I was unschooling. And suddenly, over the course of 3 years of public high school, I read, you know, 3 books on my own. I was fixated on this idea of getting into a good college like everybody else. And so the story sort of culminates in me going to Brown University, and I've climbed to the top of this academic hierarchy.
Mm-hmm. One of the elite schools in the Ivy League.
I also went to Brown.
And then being there at the, you know, first student assembly of, you know, all of the freshmen, and they say, you're here because you're the smartest and the best.
I had the exact same reaction.
Yeah, and I said, no, we're not. We're the kids who kissed up to our teachers and who wrote resumes even though we were 17 years old and, you know, hustled for good grades. We're not the smartest. You know, we're not necessarily the best. And I just came out of this public high school in Georgia in which 85% of the students are African-American, and they're all attracted into the vocational and general studies. And then the minority of white students are funneled into college prep. And so there's a lie there. And I think unschooling does, you know, and so I also say that when I dropped out of Brown after that year, my dad said, oh, I'm happy you got that silly Ivy League thing out of your system. And that was sort of the spirit of unschooling was, well, learn for its own sake.
Okay, well, Dana, let me turn to you. I mean, what about the critique that Astra is making of so much schooling that there's something rote about it? It is not learning for its own sake.
I think she's making a really important point about the fact that far too often public schools and all schools, frankly, they sort of renew race and class hierarchies by directing less privileged students to less academically and intellectually demanding tracks. Going to Brown, also from public high school, also from a diverse public high school, like Astra, I had very much the same reaction on that day when they sit you all down and say, you're the best of the best, you deserve to be here. I also had that reaction like, oh, I'm here because I'm very privileged. Mm-hmm. I don't deserve it more than the Black kid who sat next to me in class back in fourth grade. And by the time we got to 12th grade, we didn't see each other except in the cafeteria because we were on totally different tracks. And my parents were pushing me, and I was pushing myself because I had those educational values from home. So she's making a very important critique. In 2007, once I was out in the professional world working as an education reporter, I went back to my hometown, which is Ossining, New York, where I attended public school, and I wrote a long article about what they had done in the last decade to try to address this problem of the fact that the administrators in the district acknowledged that students of color were being tracked into less demanding courses, and they were trying to fix the problem. So again, the approach that I take to my journalism about education is when I identify a problem with the public school systems, a broadly acknowledged problem in this case, I try to look for a public school district that's coming up with a solution, because the fact of the matter is 90% of American children are in the public schools, and it's going to stay that way. And unschooling, homeschooling, it is an interesting thought experiment. It's not an option for most families. So when we're looking to solutions to these entrenched problems like tracking, I do want to make the argument that we should look to the public system, look to the best schools that are trying very hard to come up with a solution.
I want to follow up, Dana, on actually one of your later columns in response to what Astra said. You stated that your own belief is that the typical child, at least one who is not disabled or has special needs, should go to school. You say homeschooling does not comport with crucial social justice values related to investing in the common good. This, of course, has offended a lot of homeschooling parents.
I got a lot of emails about it.
I mean, frankly, this is, a far more radical argument than what Astra is saying, because you're being much more prescriptive. And you're basically saying that the vast majority of parents who are homeschooling their kids should not be doing that. I mean, even though they obviously have personal reasons for wanting to homeschool their own children.
I think this goes to a deeper question of what sort of progressivism or what sort of liberalism does one subscribe to. I think you can think about a sort of common good liberalism in which we're investing in social institutions and we're looking for people in a society to share more common experiences, or one of individual rights where you're more concerned with the individual child, what's best for them, the individual parent, their right to exercise choice in education for their kids. I think I subscribe more to the school of common good. In America, the sort of liberalism that dominates our political discourse is more on the libertarian side. It's more interested in individual choice. And I think if you look at other Western democracies, they have valued the idea of people having common experiences, whether it's national service or in school. And I think we can have a little bit more of that in the United States. I think it would make us a stronger society.
Well, let me just follow up on this, because it sounds like you're saying, I mean, this is a really interesting definition of what it means to be progressive, because it sounds like you're saying you may need to sacrifice what's best for your own children in order to serve the greater public good, which in your argument is a viable public school system.
I'm not exactly making that argument, because like you said in reading the excerpt from my piece, I think that a lot of individuals benefit from this experience of having shared experiences with peers who are different from them. And I believe that very strongly. And in part, it's because, and I think like Astra, I'm shaped by my own childhood, by my own experiences. I had a very positive experience attending public school. So, and it's very hard for me to even imagine what my professional life would be like, what my value system would be had I not had that incredible experience. So I come to the conversation for sure with my own biases.
Mm-hmm. Astra, do you accept this definition of what it means to be progressive?
That you have to sacrifice for the common good? Yes, in a sense, but I think that what Dana is actually proposing is kind of an individual fix. In other words, each person should buy into the public school system by sending their kids to make her argument work, you would have to actually send your kid to a troubled public school.
If you really want to live out these values, pick the worst school, because right. Then you are going to invest in that school to try to make it better.
Yes. And, you know, actually, that would be quite an interesting experiment if groups of parents did that and coordinated and all sent their kids at the same time and invested in that institution. I think that's an interesting idea. Another option would be for people like Dana and I, who have the option to go to Ivy League schools, to go to community colleges, you know, and to carry those values into our adult life instead of relentlessly climbing the hierarchies that continue these divisions as we grow older. But I think that this idea that unschooling reflects a kind of distrust in the public sphere or a retreat from the common good, I actually really disagree with that. And I think that if we start pitting individualism against the public, we're going to always be stuck conceptually. So one reason why I spent so much time at the Albany Free School is that it essentially is like unschooling in community. And actually, they call themselves a democratic school. And the idea is that actually to function in a democracy, you have to be able to express your individuality and to be able to negotiate and relate to other individuals and to work things out. So the kids who go to this school, they get to be part of every major decision, including voting on the faculty and the staff. They can kick teachers out if they like. And so this is something that prepares young people and equips them to be active citizens in a democracy, a conventional public school where you're told what to do every minute, where you need a hall pass, where you're not even allowed to, you're not trusted even to go to the bathroom, doesn't, in my opinion.
So the question then is whether that kind of structure that you're talking about at the Albany Free School, whether that can translate into public schools, into, let's say, public schools in a big city, or is that a unique case?
Well, I mean, it probably has a lot to do with the scale and size of the institution, and this is why there's endless debate about, you know, student-teacher ratios and all of that, and you know, people are up in arms, rightfully, about the size of some public schools. So, I mean, there's no reason, in my opinion, that some of these values couldn't be instituted by publicly funded institutions, and I don't think, you know, in one of my rebuttals to Dana, I said I believe in free, universal, public education, but I meant free as in, you know, you should not be charged for it. You should not be charged a fee in addition to the taxes you're already paying, but also that it should be aimed at freedom. It should be about creating a space where people are free to learn, are able to be citizens in a free society and, you know, part of a democracy. I don't know. I don't see these values as necessarily antagonistic. It depends how they're expressed.
Mm-hmm. Dana?
Yeah, in reading Astra's essay in N+1, I was fascinated by the pedagogy and the curriculum and all the practices of the Albany Free School. I think it's important to note that there are many public schools that embrace many of these values in terms of the sort of civic and social good of schooling and the sort of freedom that Astra is talking about. I mean, for example, here in New York City, we have the Democracy Prep Schools, which are all about this idea of building students' civic capacity. And it's important to look, I think, at the public schools that are attempting to embrace these models as opposed to private schools, because they're operating within the system of standards and accountability that all public schools are expected to adhere to, and yet they're still finding a way to live out these values. And that's the reality. The political reality is that we need to find a way to bring progressive educational values to kids who are in the public system. And the standards and accountability conversation is not going away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm absolutely for looking at successful public school examples. I think if we have a conversation in which we pretend that all public schools are as good as these examples, or all people have an experience that's like Dana's, where, you know, there's a sort of mix of students and, you know, it's integrated, that we're not having an honest argument. Because, for example, going back to my childhood in Georgia, I say at the end of my essay, I experienced unschooling as a compromise. It was the more appealing of two extremes. One was staying home and guiding my own learning, and the other was going to school and being told what to do every day in a building that had no windows, you know, and feeling like I was not trusted. And there were, you know, police at every door and, you know, every intersection of the hallway. And so to me, that's an extreme. The public school system in many instances is extreme. And we should wonder why there's not more middle ground.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I agree with that. I'm not denying that there are many, many failing public schools. I'm, in fact, making an argument about what to do about that problem, which is to look for the public schools that have successfully addressed these issues and to think about how to more broadly implement their strategies.
But I think there's a more radical challenge, which is we put so much energy into education and so much time and effort and give students so much attention so that kids can end up where I ended up, right, at something like Brown University. So there is something provocative about the idea that if you just let your kid go free and you surround them with interesting stuff, they might end up at the same point anyway.
Yes, right? I think if you surround them with interesting is the crucial part of that, because we know that only half of American kids, for example, have books at home and are read to every day.
Absolutely. I'm not disputing that. I'm bracketing that question, right? I'm saying that, but there are plenty of kids who come from homes like yours where there are lots of books around and the parents are educators and you still, you know, went through the rigmarole of school every day for 13 years to get to where I got anyway. So I'm just saying there's something very provocative about that idea. If you look at, for example, my brother who unschooled, did his own thing for years, and then last year finally had he's 26, he had a baby and he thought I should probably get a profession. And he just studied for the LSAT and, you know, did fine, you know, did great. And so I'm saying that there is something there, as much as I agree with this conversation about public schools and investing in them and I'm sympathetic to all of the challenges they're facing and all of the attacks on them from the right wing, there's still something interesting about the fact that you can get away with doing a lot less.
I want to step back for a moment and ask each of you a larger question, and that is, what's the underlying purpose of education? What's the ultimate goal? Dana, how would you respond to that?
Well, I think there's a lot of debate about that question, and it goes all throughout American history, and I'm not going to suggest a single answer, but I'll give you some idea of what some of the answers have been over time. One idea, I think probably the simplest one, is it's for the betterment of the individual, to help them achieve their goals, their professional goals in life, their personal goals. Another one would be that we're educating people to be better Americans, to better perform their civic duties, to be engaged in the political sphere in an intelligent, reasoned way. You know, back in the 19th century when the public school system first started in the United States, most educators, most teachers were most concerned with students' moral development, the idea that you should help children build a moral character. And I think right now in our education reform debate, we talk a lot about this idea of global competition, the idea of making our students able to compete on the job market economically with their peers all around the world. And that's why we talk so much about test scores, which I agree with Astor, there's way too much focus on test scores.
Okay, so you've just given me a lot of reasons over history, I mean, sort of different objectives. What about for you? I mean, what for you is the ideal learning environment?
I think the ideal learning environment for me would be one where students of many different backgrounds are gathered together in a classroom and they are inquiring together about intellectual questions, reading, writing, talking about what they're reading. That to me is the ideal learning environment. And I think the goal of public schooling is to create students who can think critically, who can ask questions about the information that they're presented with, and who know how to solve problems. If they're presented, for example, with a political speech, they can question whether they're being told the truth, and they know how to go find the information to figure that out.
Okay. Astra, what about you? What is the ideal learning environment?
Oh, well, I mean, I think, you know, one thing I experienced when I transitioned into public school was this sort of shock at how much time was wasted. And I sort of wished that there could be a situation and this is, you know, what I wished in high school, was that there was like rigor and then there was freedom. I just felt that the day, you know, going from 8 a.m. to 3 p.m. was so bloated, and they were kind of just keeping us entertained and keeping us busy or keeping us in the building off the streets. So as a younger student who's you know, getting the basic skills, the grounding in subjects we believe everybody should know, math, you know, basic math, science, civics, all of that, I would say, you know, this is something that was delineated more clearly between sort of rigor and free time instead of blending it together. But the real utopian vision of education I have is something where it's like the option of perpetual free graduate school for people of all ages, not just education diversity in terms of economics and race, but also in terms of age. And I think that's one of the things about unschooling I really appreciated, was that we weren't sort of indoctrinated into the ageism that regular school is based on, where, okay, if you're 8, then you don't talk to the 9-year-olds because they're in the next grade. And this idea that you can learn from anyone, and also you can be learning with anyone, even if they're a different age from you. And I think that you know, unschooling is a lifelong project. We shouldn't just stop learning because we've graduated. That's not what happens. So I would love to see that integrated into our education system if we're going to dream, you know, a space for people to keep studying, keep learning. And I do want to say that if we look at the history of education, we have to, there is this sort of beautiful humanist story of, you know, learning for its own sake and this idea of sort of classical education, but there's also, you know, education for a career, for a vocation. And those things are our intention. And I think, you know, unschooling, it's unclear that it addresses, you know, the issue of the career as well as going to regular school. And I think that's sort of a part of the story of public schooling that we've kind of left off the table. Mm-hmm. That is as much woven into its history as everything else we've been talking about.
So Dana, do you think, because I'm guessing you would share some of those values that Astor has just been talking about, can public schools develop the flexibility to create this kind of more creative learning environment?
Yeah, I think absolutely they can. In fact, I wrote an article for The Nation last year about a bunch of schools that are trying to combine really high intellectual rigor with a sort of update on the concept of vocational education. So getting kids thinking about possible careers a bit younger at 13, 14, 15 years old, and thinking about how to combine sort of college readiness standards, so high intellectual standards, with the idea of thinking creatively about how you might use those skills out in the real world.
You know, in this conversation, too, we've been talking about schools as social levelers. There's this tension between this idea, are schools social levelers, or do they reinforce the class pyramid by sorting and tracking kids from a young age? And I guess one thing I would say is that the sort of standard line is that education is the key to success. And if we just educate all of our students and are competitive, then we will sort of pull ourselves out of poverty, right? We'll pull everybody
up.
I disagree with that,
I'm sure you do.
Yeah, and I just think that that's basically, you know, a myth. And so if we're talking about the ultimate, you know, there are other less roundabout ways, I think, of addressing the bigger underlying social problems that Dana and I keep, you know, bringing you back into this conversation, like unions and workers' rights and progressive taxation. And, you know, education is not the number one way, the number strategy I would vote on for addressing those larger issues of inequality in the United States at this moment.
I agree with that, with the caveat that education still works very well for individual children who are lucky enough to benefit from great schools. It does help individual children transcend poverty, move into the middle class and the upper middle class. I mean, it is still one successful route that is available in our society.
Am I right that neither of you has children?
I don't have children yet.
No.
If you do, how will each of you approach the education of your own children? Have you thought about that?
Well, I assume their future father will have a say in that.
Of course, of course, yes. But I mean, just sort of you're both deeply interested in these questions. To bring it home, you know, how
I've thought about it a lot, and I certainly intend to send my children to public school, and I certainly intend to send them to public schools that are racially and socioeconomically diverse. It was such an important part of my own childhood and such a positive experience for me. It's something I'd very much want to pass on to them.
Okay, Astra?
I think I would continue the tradition of giving my kids a choice. You know, I have friends with kids, and their children absolutely love going to school every day and look forward to it. And so if I had a child who was like that, I would say, oh, that's great. I guess I get more time to sit at home and do my own thing. But I don't think that if they were deeply unhappy, as I was when I tried, for example, fourth grade, I wouldn't force them to stay because it was theoretically better for the public school system to have them in there. If they were as unhappy as I was in school, or as unhappy as my sister, who the school refused to mainstream because of her physical disability, if they were as unhappy as she was, I definitely wouldn't make them stay. If I lived near one of these progressive schools that was innovating in interesting ways, as Dana's described, well, all the better. I would certainly be open to an option like that.
Okay. Thank you, Astra Taylor and Dana Goldstein. Thank you both very much.
Thank you so much. This was
fun. Thank you.